WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We'd planned to bring you an interview with jazz musician and arranger Jerry Mulligan, but that's been rescheduled for the next Fresh Air. My guest today is Ken Kesey. Kesey wrote two of the more popular novels of the 1960s. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is set in a mental institution where the patients finally rebel against the sterile, repressive hospital regimen. Sometimes a Great Notion is set in Oregon logging country. But in some circles, Kesey became even better known as being one of the first people to bring the experimental hallucinogenic LSD out of the research laboratory and into the culture. Kesey and his friends, known as the Merry Pranksters, were among the first and most celebrated of the West Coast hippies. In the book The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Tom Wolfe described the pranksters' escapades driving around the country in their Dayglo school bus. The driver was usually Neil Cassady, who was immortalized as the character Dean Moriarty in Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road. Ken Kesey hasn't published much since the 60s and has remained pretty much out of the public eye. He lives on a farm in Oregon. His short pieces from the past two decades were collected in the 1986 book Demon Box. His latest project is the book Caverns. It's a collaborative novel written by the students in his writing class at the University of Oregon. The authorship is credited to O.U. Levin, which is an anagram for the University of Oregon novel. The book includes an introduction by Kesey. I asked Ken Kesey why he had his class write a collective novel.
It's an idea I've had for a long time, for a number of reasons. I feel that a lot of writing classes end up being in competition with each other, and that's the best they get out of it, that is kind of intellectual, literary infighting. And we came out of a very exceptional class in the 60s that all of us who were part of the class are kind of in awe of now that it's passed. And I wanted to create this same sense of all of us being part of a team working for the same goal at the end of the project, and so that we weren't in competition with each other in any form.
Did you do writing yourself?
We all did, yeah. Mm-hmm. When we first met, I told him there's only two rules that I have for this class. One is that we can't tell anybody the plot of the novel until it's done. Your wife, no reporters, nobody, no English professors. And the other one was that I make up half the class, so that if it came down to a real argument about where the novel was going, that all they could do was tie me up. They couldn't... All I had to do is browbeat one of them, it would go my direction. I told them, this is not democracy, this is art, and we've got to keep going forward with it, because otherwise we'll get in there, we'll be talking about the difference between Henry James and Hemingway.
How much writing have you been doing over the past few years?
Oh, quite a lot. I write all the time. Mm-hmm. I just don't publish that much. For one thing, I've got a lot of other stuff that I'm doing, like just coming from doing this rehearsal of it at Lincoln Center with a Trick of the Squirrel piece. I've done that a number of times and traveled around the country doing it. I've got a large farm. I was going pretty good on a book in 1984 and had a kid die, and it really took the wind out of my sails, and I felt like working with this class at the University of Oregon got me moving again. I'm turning out quite a bit of manuscript now that I haven't for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, you say something in the introduction to Caverns that I wanted to ask you about. You write that you'd studied with Wallace Degner at Stanford, and you write that in your university days he mistook you for an anti-intellectual, but what you really were was a near illiterate. Elaborate on that.
Well, as I told you, I majored in radio and television. I knew Fibber McGee and Molly and Jack Benny, but I wasn't too well versed in Faulkner and William Blake. Those were new things to me. When I got down to Stanford, I realized that I was not nearly as well read as most of the other people in the class.
Were you uncomfortable about that? Did you feel like you had all this catching up to do?
I felt like a country fool walked in with stuff between my toes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're living on your farm now.
Same old farm, yeah.
You know, it's funny. In your prankster days, you were seen as being part of a group that had made such a break with the past. And yet here you are living on a family farm. It had been owned by someone else in your family before you. You're, I believe, still married to the woman who you've been married to since, what is it, 1956?
Long time, yeah.
Yeah. So, sure. I mean, there's been this incredible continuity in your life between past and present in a lot of ways.
Well, old Tommy Wolfe has a lot to do with that misconception. When New York wants to view somebody's personality, they want it in terms of a sound bite. They don't want to have it get too complex. It's like coming over here tonight. We got out there in the traffic, and we come in here late. And I just hate to come into a place late because I know that's what they expect of me, you know, because of my prankster upbringing. I know that, here he is. He's late. He's probably messed up. But I'm not. I've always been a fairly reliable, straight-up-the-middle-of-the-road citizen that just happens to be an acid head.
You say that you blame Tommy Wolfe for these misconceptions about you're referring to Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Did you like the book?
Oh, yeah, it's a good book. Yeah.
And do you feel... Yeah, go ahead.
He's a... Wolfe's a genius. He did a lot of that stuff. He's only around 3 weeks. He picked up that amount of dialogue and verisimilitude without tape recorder, without taking notes to any extent. He just watches very carefully and remembers. But, you know, he's got his own editorial filter there, and so what he's coming up with is part of me, but it's not all of me, you know, any more than Hunter S. Thompson is loaded all the time and shooting machine guns at John Denver. That's the sort of thing that, interesting in the media, but he's got a lot more life to him than that.
Ken Kesey is my guest, and he has a new book that's actually a collaborative book that was written by his students, and the book is called Caverns. What effect did the electric Kool-Aid acid test have on you? For instance, did it make the police feel more determined to try to bust you again?
Yeah, but I haven't been worried about the cops that much. The effect Kool-Aid acid test has is it's as though, say, that you're Richard Gere and you got a great big wart on the side of your nose, and they begin to play it up in the cameras, and then pretty soon it becomes a thing that a lot of teenage girls are in love with, and then pretty soon you're looking at it too until you're cross-eyed looking at your own wart.
Why do you use the wart as an analogy?
Well, because I was a lot more than the Tom Wolfe depiction, and mm-hmm. I think this is a problem for a lot of American writers and has been for a long time. You know, Hemingway, he doesn't really get into trouble until he becomes dazzled by his own image. He sees the rest of the United States looking at him, and he moves over and sits there and he looks at himself too, and then when he tries to go back and get inside of his own skin, he can't quite fit into it as well as he used to. He's gained weight. He can't put his own skin back on. And when you're writing, it's not a good idea to be observed too much, unless you want to live in New York and wear white clothes. If you really are interested in being a real straight, old-fashioned writer, it's better to live down in Mississippi like Faulkner and work out in the woodshed and not be seen but once every 10 years. I think that being the observed always turns your eye back on yourself, and you become kind of blinded by your own radiance.
You started doing LSD through a government experiment, an experimental program, and I think it was 1959. And you were one of the volunteers who volunteered to take this experimental drug and have it tested on yourself. How did you become a volunteer for these experiments?
One of the guys that was our neighbors was a psychologist, and he was supposed to show up one day and just really didn't have the common hair to do it, and says, "Would anybody else like to take my place?" And I, at the time, was training for the Olympics. I made it to be an alternate in the 1960 Olympics team and was in
good
shape.
As a wrestler?
Yeah, as a wrestler. I'd never been drunk on beer. know, let alone done any drugs, but this is the American government. They said, come in here. We've just discovered this new spot of space, and we want somebody to go up there and look it over, and we don't want to do it. We want to hire you students. And I was one of 140 or so that it eventually turned out it was CIA-sponsored. I didn't believe it for a long time. Well, Allen Ginsberg says, you know who was paying for that? It was the CIA. I said, oh, no, Allen, you're just paranoid. But he finally got all the darn records, and it did turn out the CIA was doing this, and it wasn't being done to try to cure insane people, which is what we thought. It was being done to try to make people insane, to weaken people and to be able to put them under the control of interrogators. This didn't, we didn't find this out for 20 years. And by that time, the government had said, okay, stop that experiment. All these guinea pigs that we've sent up there into outer space, bring them back down, and don't ever let them go back up there again, because we don't like the look in their eyes.
Do you remember what your very first trip was like when you were a volunteer in this government program? And what kind of preparation were you given for it? Were you given any?
None at all. Except I'd read a little piece in Life magazine about how they'd given it to cats, and cats were afraid of mice once they'd had LSD. But I think that we'd been preparing for a long time. You know, I knew the Bible. I knew the Bhagavad Gita. I knew the Tao Te Ching. I had read Hermann Hesse's Journey to the East, which gave us an underpinning spiritually so that these phenomena that were happening to us had something that we could relate to. I think a lot of people who are just jumping into drugs now, they don't have anything to relate it to, and I think people have been, for one thing, people have been doing psychedelics for thousands and thousands of years, trying to find out what's on the real books, and we just happened to come at a time when it was not only a lot of stuff happening chemically, there was a lot of new changes in music and in film. Burroughs was just beginning to do his work in literature. There was a movement afoot that this was just a part of, and mm-hmm. It was exciting. It was wonderful.
What was that very first trip like, though, under the experimental conditions?
Groovy, man. It was groovy. We suddenly realized that there's a lot more to this world than we previously thought. I think, because I'm asked this question a lot, it's been 20 years or so, and people are always coming back saying, well, what do you think? And one of the things that I think came out of it is that there's room. We don't all have to be the same. We don't have to have Baptists coast to coast. We can throw in some Buddhists and some Christians and people who are just thinking totally strange thoughts about the Irish leprechauns, that there is room spiritually for everybody in this universe.
Mm-hmm. You were among the first people to take LSD out of the clinical setting and use it in a social setting. How did you first get it out?
Of the hospital?
Yeah.
Ooh. Well, after I'd gone through these drug experiments and was in this little room in the hospital, looking out through the little window at the people out there who were the regular nuts, they weren't students going through experiments, looking at them through my crazed eyes, I saw that these people have something going and there's a truth to it that people are missing, and that's how I came to write Cuckoo's Nest. I got a job at the Nut House and worked from midnight to 8, writing that book and taking care of these patients on this one ward, and made a lot of good friends, some that I still have. And I found that my key opened a lot of the doors to the doctor's offices where these drugs were being kept. That's how.
Huh. And then you had friends who were able to make it in their own laboratories.
Yeah, but they never was anywhere as good as that good government stuff. That's the government. The CIA always has the best stuff.
You know, you brought up Cuckoo's Nest, and I was wondering, when you were working in the psychiatric ward, which is what Cuckoo's Nest is based on, and I think you sometimes went in there high on hallucinogenics. Do you think you ended up writing Cuckoo's Nest in a way, projecting your experiences as a quote sane person high on drugs, projecting those experiences onto people who maybe had like serious problems?
Well, these people had had serious problems. I mean, I saw people hallucinating and people in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
Make no mistake about it. Being crazy is painful, and being crazy is hell, whether you get it from taking a drug or whether it happens because you're just trying to lead the American way of life and it keeps kicking your legs out from under you. One way or another, it's hell on you, and it's nothing that's fun about it, and I am certainly not recommending it. It is a lens through which I looked at stuff, but it's hard on the eyes. But I think I had a very valid viewpoint, and much closer than a lot of the doctors were having. At that time, you know, everything was Freudian. If you were messed up, it was because of something that had happened to you when you were in the bathroom as a kid. And with these experiences, not, and I don't just mean drug experiences. There were a lot of other things that were going on that were emphasizing this. John Coltrane's music was saying the same thing. It was saying something is wrong and it's making us a little crazy, and that is making us crazy enough to hallucinate. Whether we were promoting it ourselves or it was being imposed on us, I don't want to argue that now. But when I felt so good after being on there all night to know that I was wearing a green uniform, and I mean a white uniform instead of a green uniform, so I could leave in the morning and go home. Otherwise, there wasn't that much difference between me and those people they were locking up.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me an empathy that I could never have come up with. A better example is those first three pages of Cuckoo's Nest were written on peyote. And I don't know any Indians. I don't know where that Indian came from. I've always felt humbled by that character. Without the character of that Indian, the book is a melodrama. You know, it's a straight battle between McMurphy and the big nurse. But that Indian's consciousness, to filter that through, that makes it exceptional.
Did you find that hallucinogenics would bring out things in your writing, or did you find also that sometimes it would be hard to write when you were high?
Oh, you see a lot of really groovy stuff on hallucinogenics and write it down and 24 hours look at it and realize, you know, I can't even read this. So there were a lot of mistakes made by everybody who thought they were doing wonderful creative works high on drugs, and then later on found that what they were doing was finger painting.
Have you given up drugs, or I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be asking this, but
we're into it now, go ahead.
Do you still do them at all? Or?
On religious occasions, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like to walk up on a mountain on Easter and get a sense of rebirth. Some people jog, some people meditate. You know, there's certain people who whip themselves on the back. Everybody has their own way of trying to see past the veil, and this is just the one that I happened to come up with.
At what point did you decide to give up the kind of prankster's life? The story that I've heard is the pranksters went to Woodstock. You didn't want to go. And when they came back to a sign hung in your driveway that just said, no.
Well, there were 61 people when they headed out to Woodstock, and after they were gone, I went upstairs, and we live in a barn. We still live in the same barn, and we've fixed it up, and it's a pretty nice place. But at that time, there was still hay in the loft of the barn, and I found one of these little hippie warrens where they dug in with their ratty old sleeping bags and their copy of Zap magazine, and stuck right down in the hay bale was a candle, which had burned right down to the hay before it had gone off. And I thought, hey, enlightenment's one thing, but being this loose is, I mean, my grandpa wouldn't allowed them up there, and my great-grandpa wouldn't have, and there's certain things that take precedent over enlightenment.
And that's when you send everybody home, basically.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, did you foresee in the 60s the drug problems of the 80s? Where?
No, not at all. Actually, I did in some way. I had I spoke to a bunch of citizens at the University of Oregon in probably 1969, and I told them that this was coming, that the best thing to do about it would be to separate marijuana from all the other drugs by legalizing marijuana. I said that a long, long time ago, and I still believe it, that all of these other drugs which are connected to marijuana, and I really don't know much about those. That's why I don't get into them. I've never seen any of the stuff they're talking about, the crack and ice and stuff. So I kind of keep my talking about drugs, about the stuff I know, and I really don't fool with it very much. My metaphor is this, is that you don't need a huge tuning fork. We used to think we used to have a tuning fork 8 foot long and weighed 2,000 pounds just to find middle C, but now all you need is a little bitty tuning fork once a year, maybe. But no, I don't know anybody who really goes out and gets ripped anymore. And I do feel some responsibility for what's come about. Although I've never tried to sell drugs, there's not enough to go around. I've always tried to sell truth. Just let people tell the truth about it, and pretty soon I think people will work it out, just like with cigarettes. Gradually, by telling the truth about cigarettes, less and less men are smoking. A lot of women are still smoking, but less and less men are smoking.
Ken Kesey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, take it easy.